This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. My name is Joanna Ebenstein. I'm the founder of Morbid Anatomy, which is an organization and community devoted to these very themes. Before we begin today, if you've been enjoying this podcast and wish to support it, we have now launched an official merchandise store where you will find t-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, and more, all featuring our gorgeous logo designed by Lauren Seeley, a death doula and a member of the Morbid Anatomy community. You can check out the collection at mementomorbidmerch.dashery.com. And as you probably already know, Memento Morbid is an independently produced podcast, so anything you purchase helps support the podcast and allows us to keep bringing these conversations to you. To that end, we also now have a Buy Me a Coffee page, so if you would like to support Memento Morbid directly, you can make a small donation there. Any donation is appreciated. You can find that at buymeacoffee.com/Memento Morbid Podcast. Today's guest has spent her lifetime finding beauty where many people see only darkness. Through extraordinary objects connected with death, memory, and the human body, she has helped countless people reconsider what it means to collect, preserve, and honor the past.
I see an object. Oh, the little heavenly choir. It sings to me. I don't necessarily keep the most valuable stuff or the most expensive stuff at all. I keep the things that speak to me. They vibrate on my level. Oscar Wilde probably had a great way of putting it. And also, because they're things I find on my travels and not things I buy at auction, they have a meaning. Like, I'm so, this is my life. It's sort of like a big memory box.
Today, I'm delighted to welcome Evan Michelson. Evan is an antiques dealer, a curator, a collector, and a brilliant writer. She is also one of the people most responsible for bringing the world of curiosity collecting to the general public. Many of you might remember her from her Discovery series Oddities, and others might have visited her amazing shop, Obscura Antiques and Oddities, in New York's East Village. I personally had the pleasure of knowing and being friends with Evan for many years. She was the first person, literally, that I met in my entire life who shared my morbid interests and has been a dear friend and many times collaborator ever since. Evan, welcome to Memento Morbid. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. So I've known you since, oh my goodness, I think I met you in like 2006. Is that possible?
Yeah, sometime in the early, after the millennium.
Yeah, after the millennium, but before I started Morbid Anatomy, crucially, because that was definitely something after you. And so I met Evan, if some listeners out there might remember, a platform called Friendster. And a mutual friend and I had gone on a Friendster date, and he took me to Obscura. This is Blake, remember?
That was Blake, yeah.
And I had, in my whole life, I've had the interests that animate Morbid Anatomy today, but I had not met a single person before I met you that didn't think I was weird for liking what I liked. So there was this moment when we were introduced, and I remember it was like a bolt of lightning, or it almost was disturbing. I was like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. You know, like, these people are into exactly what I'm into. And so just to set the scene, Evan and her then business partner, Mike, ran this shop in the East Village, which is a very cool area of New York City. And it was filled with the kind of things I love. It was filled with wax anatomical models and wonky taxidermy and 18th century prints. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what people might have seen if they came into Obscura back then. And it's that location.
Right. So, well, that's a good New York story, because a gentleman named Adrian Gilbo, who you had met, started a shop called Wandering Dragon Trading Company. And the location was a tenement in the East Village where rent was $250. Damn. That's how old we are.
Wow.
And there wasn't really a floor. There was a subfloor. And there was no ceiling, but nobody ever noticed. There was just like gold lame, and you'd see the mice running around. And we had one radiator this big, and off and on running water. It was a true the last of the old East Village, and it was kind of a magical place. It was like a ghost ship. People described it as a ghost ship, and they'd go in, and then they'd go back to wherever they came from, and they'd be like, "Did that really happen? I could have sworn." And we'd be open at like 2 a.m. with like, lights on the sidewalk, and it was very boho East Village dream. I guess from the earliest iteration, we sold everything that was kind of overlooked and unwanted in those days. Just hard to imagine. So, medical, anatomical, antiques, surgical instruments, wonky. Actually, incredible taxidermy. It came out of museums, the kind of stuff that just doesn't happen anymore. All kinds of photographs, exotic textiles, just things from all over the world that were not conventionally beautiful.
I think it's a beautiful way to put it.
And so it was a great business to be in because at that time people weren't buying that. So life was easier then. There's more of it around, and we could buy it because people were like, who would ever want that? So that's what the shop was for many, many, many years.
And then the space that you created with all of those objects attracted like-minded people. So I always felt when I visited, because once I was introduced, you very kindly said, come back. And I kept coming back and we became friends. But every time I went, I would meet interesting people. It was like a crossroads of like-minded people. And there wasn't any other place. I think they weren't many. There was no other place that I discovered for people of our predilections, our morbid predilections. And it was just wonderful. And that makes me think one of the previous episodes we've had for sharp-eared listeners, you might remember us talking about obscure antiques and oddities when I interviewed Lee Okrick, who had a toy in Toy Story 3 that was based on something he bought. So there's this wonderful web, where morbid anatomy is part of it and obscura is part of it. I would love to know how you got into these things or when you first knew that what you liked was not what everyone else liked and what that meant for you and your family.
No one in my family collects things. No one in my family really likes stuff. I am the only one with this gene. Which is fine. I was a voracious reader as a child, and I had the world's best parents. And so, my father in particular was like obsessed with Edward Gorey. And they were balletta men's, and they'd go to the ballet. They had a regular subscription as soon as the building was built, and they would see Edward Gorey in his long coat. And my father actually followed him to hear. And this is unlike my father, who was very, he was a World War II Navy man, and he was like the greatest generation. He was very philosophical, but he had a whimsical side. And so he was just like, I had to hear what this gentleman was talking about. I just needed to know. And so I found out he was an artist. So my parents got me. They had Edward Gorey signed stuff, and then they would bring it home to me. So my room looked like this from the beginning. I had shelves of books on them, and I was in love with Edgar Allan Poe. I had a book of Japanese fairy tales that were extremely frightening. Ambrose Bierce was my obsession in high school. So I was into that sort of voracious reader of sort of dark literature, not exclusively, but pretty much. And then Edward Gorey made an appearance, and then when I was in high school, I discovered I was an aesthete.
And can you
So
describe for our listeners what an aesthete is?
an aesthete is. That is, I am moved by beauty to an extraordinary. I am moved and motivated by beauty. So I was a different kid. I was the kid that got picked on. I was the
Me too.
girl that didn't want to date, but was AP French. I was the nerd. But I discovered Oscar Wilde,
Mm.
And Oscar Wilde revealed to me that there was this world of people who were moved and motivated by beauty. And at that moment, I knew that I was marching to a different drummer, and I was very happy about it. But it's hard in central New Jersey in the 1970s and 80s. When I was a little girl, you didn't run across beautiful things all that often. Although the 70s were very boho, they did have beautiful textiles and
That's true.
interesting ceramics, which is a lot of what I deal now. I felt fallen back in love with it, but that was my evolution. I read, and then Edward Gorey showed up, and then Oscar Wilde showed up, and then I ended up here.
And what is here? Can you describe like what you do professionally now? And
I am an antiques dealer, and I specialize in the history of science, history of medicine, and natural history.
what I find really interesting about your trajectory is you started in this, as this kind of marginal bohemian, producing a shop for a very small niche of people, but a very influential niche of people, right? Because you, including Lee Unkrich, but other directors and
Oh my
celebrities.
God, actors, actresses, writers. Kiki Smith was a customer for
That's
many years.
amazing.
Like we were a humble little store, but it was like the world's greatest salon. I shouldn't say world's greatest. It was a great New York salon
I
where it
agree
was
with
just
that.
minded people came in and out every day. Some of them became very famous. Some didn't, but still do good work. But yeah, we were a hub for sure.
Yes, and then something happened. Something changed, and you became more than this tiny little niche thing.
Yeah, it's still hard to cast my mind back to the fact that that did happen.
Yeah, I
It was
know.
very strange. Discovery Science wanted a reality show that was based on scientific things. And so Mike and I were just sitting there minding our own business, and these people came into the shop and they said, "We'd like to film with you for like 10 minutes. Just give us your name and say what you do, and then we'll take some shots and then we'll leave." And we said, "Okay." So they did that. And then they were like, "Oh, it's for the show. It's in development. We'll let you know if anything happens." So then they call and they'd say, "Oh, there's 20 people on the list. Now there's 10 people on the list. Now there's 5 people on the list." And then you got a TV show. So that's what happened. Like it happened like that. It was the craziest friggin' thing. And Mike, being an extrovert and very fond of media, I was like, "Yes." And I was like, "Oh, I'm an introvert. I'm not on social media much to this day." It was a great opportunity.
Yeah.
We went on the air very quickly. Within a few months of we started filming, and the show went to number one, and it stayed there for a long time. So we had this reality TV show, but it was about the shop, and it was about medical, scientific, natural history stuff. And it was about the people who came in.
Yeah.
So I struggled with it mightily because, and this is only 2010, but they didn't really like women in any positions of authority.
Yeah, I
So
think you
ladies.
could talk a little bit about that. I think that would be interesting, like that. I think that is a peek at so-called reality television is how it's
Yeah.
not, I mean, how it's pushed into what people think
Yep.
is going to be
Ladies.
saleable.
The struggle is real.
Yeah.
So when the show started, I wasn't doing my own thing. I noticed I didn't have much time. I wasn't doing my own thing. And I complained a bit. I complained to the network. Network said that it was the production company, and the production company said it was the network.
Wow.
So, and I didn't, I wasn't happy to begin with. I was stressed to begin with. But they sat me down. Two gentlemen sat me down and they said, "Your audience skews young and male, and they will not be comfortable with a woman in position of authority."
Wow. They just said it like that.
Women should be seen and not heard. And they said, "Plus, you're
Women should
genuine."
be. Oh, my goodness.
Well, okay. That's my
Okay,
interpretation.
okay,
They did
okay.
not literally say that. They said they're uncomfortable with women doing things.
Sorry, but that's
And
kind of
I.
amazing.
It's to totally, but this is 2010.
Yeah.
And they said, "Plus, you're generally weird because I am somewhat awkward." And I was like, that the whole point of the show.
Yeah. Yes.
One of the weird things. We had a productive discussion and they said, you know, if you want to do things, you write it.
Huh.
So we weren't scripted in our, it's a little bit in the weeds. Oddities was about as real as a reality show could get. You saw.
Yes.
You were pretty.
I was on the cutting room floor. So I know a little bit about that.
Good for you.
It's okay. It didn't keep me up at night.
But you saw, like, they try to manipulate reality.
Absolutely. They wanted me to say certain things that I wasn't comfortable saying.
Absolutely not. So, you know, Mike and I were very much not into manipulating reality.
Yeah.
So we stood our ground. There was a lot of fighting back and forth. They said, you want things to happen, then you write them. So I actually got to write for, you know, when I say write, I don't mean dialogue. Yeah. I mean, like, certain people, like, oh, my God, Jonathan, puppeteer.
Jonathan Cross.
Great. And I got this. And, like, we had the most delightful time, and it was a great. But I, you know, I had to write it.
I don't think I realized that.
Like, men were kind of given things, but women had to work for them.
I had to fight for them. Not just work for them, but fight for them, right?
Yes, indeed. But, you know, it turned out okay. Because it ended up doing very well. And we ended up with parody. And we ended up, when they ripped the show off, the first time they ripped it off with two females.
Wait, they ripped it off?
Yeah. They said, we're going to rip it off before anyone else does. So it was Oddities, was on the West Coast.
That's right. I remember this now. Yes.
But that was two women. So, you know.
That's interesting. So maybe you kind of showed them that there was a market, at least that it wouldn't hinder viewership if there was a woman in power. Maybe.
Well, here's the thing about reality. Well, different kinds of reality TV. Our world, the world of Oddities and Morbid Anatomy. I mean, everything overlapped.
Yeah.
Oddities and Morbid Anatomy. It was a lot of the same people.
Absolutely.
So I said, you know, our worlds are about 50-50, male, female. There's not, women and men are sort of represented equally. And the men in our world are not the kind of men who feel emasculated by a woman discussing science, you know.
Thank goodness, yes.
So they had a learning curve.
That's so interesting. So basically, in your content and in your guestship, I guess, in the people you brought on, you were representing a certain part of bohemian or subcultural America, and it was being beamed into mainstream America.
Very proud.
And they kind of had to see that this might work because they probably had no model to base this on from their own.
You know, you and me and Morbid Anatomy community and Oddities community didn't really exist in the mainstream consciousness.
Yeah.
They had no idea who we were, even though we're legion. We're everywhere. As everyone in the community knows, we're global.
Yeah.
But we had no representation in mainstream media.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
I mean, this is a slice of America that exists now, has always existed, always will exist. But it just, we were still underground. So I'm really glad that one of the things I'm proud of is that, you know, we got representation and we had a voice. And the show was our friends and...
Totally.
For the most part, it was friends with people who came into the store. It wasn't like actors playing people who are interested in something. It was people who shared our interests. So
yeah. And then, you know, what I'm thinking about too when you're talking about this is how I know you're an introvert. And so one of the things I remember that was hard for you at this time is just people started coming into the shop like a tourist attraction. And mostly that was not so great. But sometimes you would have you would always talk about these like young women from middle America who would see on TV another way to be. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Like, then I'd love to hear too, just how your show impacted the awareness of this world and what has happened since then, but also like how it showed kids who might've been alienated in their desires and their predilections, and particularly girl kids, I think. I don't know if that's true, if you would agree with that. But I remember you would always have these stories of these young women who would come in, like with their moms from Oklahoma and things like this.
Yeah, that's so near to my heart.
Yeah.
So, like I said, the show went on the air and it was instantly the number one show, and we had, I think, Saturday at 7 p.m. So we were broadcast far and wide, and it happened overnight. Maybe a few months into airing, I was at my market. I was at a grocery store near my market, and this woman walks up to me and she said, "I just want to tell you, I'm so glad you're on the air, because now my daughter doesn't watch America's Top Model. She watches you."
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's another way to be.
Yeah.
And it's okay. I think the world, or at least let's say American culture, is more comfortable with male geeks than female geeks.
That's very interesting. Yes.
Boys with weird, train spotting or science geeks, and
Yeah.
slightly less with girls who want to do their own thing and who are geeky and nerdier. So, yeah, girls would come in, they're like, "I'm going to be a marine biologist. Now I'm going to be a mortician." It was beautiful, and
Yeah.
I was proud to be a part of that. But like I said, had to fight for it
Yeah.
first.
But how rewarding that that's how it played out. Do you consider that like the greatest accomplishment of the show for you personally?
For me personally, yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, I was raised by a second wave feminist. So I grew up, my mother was researching Victoria Woodhull, and she was,
Wait, can you explain who Victoria Woodhull is for the audience?
The first American woman to run for president.
And they
And
called,
she
didn't they call her
kind of
like the devil, or wasn't this
free love.
Lady
And
Satan or something?
yes, exactly. She was a demonized. So my mother was working on that, on a project on that young lady, whose name was not on anyone's lips. She was really fascinated by 19 women's lives in the 19th century, poor and working class women, prostitutes, the horrible conditions under which women lived in the 19th century. So I kind of grew up just with hearing stories about women and women doing stuff. So that was perfectly normal to me. So then you grow up and you go, "Oh, this isn't totally normal. Not in America."
Yeah.
So yes, the thing I'm proudest of
Yeah.
is that women, you can be anything you that I was raised, a woman can be anything she wants to be. She can
Yeah.
do anything that she wants to do without question, shouldn't have to fight for it. So yeah, I'm very, that warms my heart and it makes me happy. And to this day, people still come up to me and they're like, "I watched you when I was a little kid," which is a little freaky.
Yeah. Because so much time has passed.
And you're the reason I'm selling at this flea market,
Oh, that's
or
amazing.
you're the reason I became a biologist, or like that makes me very, very happy. And that's like where the medium, reality TV is a poison and a pock globally. And we're, I think, part of the reason America is where it is because reality TV. But it could be used for good.
Yeah. Well, you got in the system and then you refused to compromise. Wait, and you got to express what you wanted to express through this medium, this mass medium, which is pretty amazing, actually.
Well, I was an old punk and
Yeah.
an East Village punk, so you don't tell an East Village punk that they can't do something or shouldn't do something. Another thing I'm proud of, we had Genesis Peorage on the show.
Yeah. Do you want to say a few words about Genesis Peorage for listeners who might not be familiar?
They founded Throbbing Gristle, which was sort of Genesis sort of coined the term industrial. Documentaries have been made on Genesis. Psychic TV, very, very, very edgy, pushed every envelope. A very influential underground industrial person, very smart, but also extremely difficult. So we filmed, Genesis was a customer who would come in. And so we kind of knew each other, and I knew Genesis from the performance art world because my husband and I were performance artists for many years. So we filmed with Genesis, and it was the hardest thing we ever did, and it was tremendously stressful people lost their minds all over America. Mm. They were like, you got Genesis P Origin prime time. I was like, yeah. That's, I'm also proud of that. Because America has this rich history of subculture, political subculture, musical subculture, artistic subculture. We push very hard. We're very progressive. But you wouldn't know it because, you know, our mainstream has always been conservative. So I was very proud that I got Genesis, we got Genesis PRH beamed into millions of wholesome American living rooms. So,
yeah, you know what that makes me think of a little bit? I know you're also a big fan of Twin Peaks, The Return. And it makes me think of episode 8 and watching episode 8 for people out there who've not watched Twin Peaks The Return, please do. And episode 8 is like a standalone art film that is challenging and subversive and explosive. And I watched it also and remember thinking exactly this, like, this is the genius of David Lynch, that he found a way not just to tell different kinds of stories and to provide subversive content, but to bring it to the mass of American people. Maybe not as big a mass as yours, because even at its height, it was not as popular as Oddities. But I have so much respect for that. And it does seem like a U.S. predilection to do this. I don't know. I'm just seeing some connection there that I think is interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, David Lynch is my favorite director. Just a little obvious, but there it is. And episode 8, I think it's the best thing I've ever seen on television.
I think I would agree.
It was high art. And again, like, America has homegrown artists. We have this thriving underground culture that's always pushed envelopes. I mean, America gave the world jazz. I mean, we have this culture that is just, for some reason, underrepresented mainstream. But David Lynch, yeah, he blew everyone's mind. I think both Twin Peaks are genius.
Yeah.
The Return as a whole is, you know, I think I've watched it a few times through.
Yeah.
But episode 8 was, yeah, his breakthrough. We're here. There are other ways of being and other ways of thinking.
Yeah.
And it's American. It's not, we don't have to borrow it.
I think that's super interesting. John Waters is another one that comes to mind, like these great American subversive thinkers, but who find a way to bring it into the mainstream, which I think I have so much respect for that and so much appreciation. Also, as myself, a teenager or a kid growing up in the suburban California, how did I find out about this stuff? You know, like ID Magazine, Night Flight, you know, like these were right. You remember, did you watch Night Flight?
I did watch Night Flight.
It was my portal. Living in the suburbs, I didn't have access to this world that you're talking about, except through these individuals who created these ways of bringing it to us. You know, I wouldn't be who I am today if I didn't have access to that. Concord, California was not a place I was going to find culture, but I could find it on Night Flight. I could find it in ID Magazine.
Yeah, I'm very spoiled because I grew up just on the other side of the George Washington Bridge. I mean, Manhattan was basically our backyard. So
yeah,
we were museum goers and culture vultures. And so the East Village, I mean, I got there just out of college. So I've been in the thick of it for my whole life, very spoiled. when we broke after filming, Genesis went out and apparently got slightly tipsy. And came back. They came up to me and they said, I am shocked that you, Miss Underground Performance, would have something to do, like reality TV. And I said, Genesis, you are going to be in everyone's living room. Your message, because Jen was talking about what they did in Nepal and the Himalayas, and they were very involved with tantric Buddhism. And I said, you get to talk about that now to like millions of people. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. You know? So there's this like unease.
That's interesting.
Yes, you're tainted by perhaps signing contracts, but you do gain, if you do not compromise, you gain a lot.
you gain a lot and you help make the world a better place, at least how we would like to see it, right? You actually get to reach people that need or could really be changed by having access to what you're doing. A lot of my own books could be academic, and I wouldn't want to write an academic book because the whole point is to get it to people that actually need it, right? Or that could be changed by it in some way. So I'm very much with that makes us populists in a way, I guess. But I think it's really important if we want to help encourage people to see that there are other ways. If they don't see it, then it's like you're in the White Tower.
So yes, you don't want to preach to the converted. And it is a form of populism.
Yeah.
And what amazes me is that it has to continue. You never win the battle. So we're here now and we've done a lot, but other people are going to have to pick up the mantle and keep going. The work never stops. So we're just part of this tradition.
Yes.
Again, American.
Well, I think that's so interesting, thinking of it as an American tradition. And that's like, I guess I think of Mark Twain there too, who was writing really popular books and encoding really subversive ideas in those books, you know?
Yeah, look at Seneca Falls. I mean, the women's movement, our movement was American.
Yeah.
We have this rich culture.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to, it never sticks. So you just have to keep talking and keep doing what you do, motivated by love and a desire to change the world, leave it a little better than you found it.
Yeah. And just to be another voice, I think it's really touching, you know, to think of all these young people, young women, who got to see a different kind of role model on television, you know, someone who was clearly very smart and a thinker and opinionated and fighting for their rights, really, you know, and also into science, which again, even that is kind of subversive in mainstream culture, as you pointed out. And of course, oddities also changed the world in lots of other ways. You know, now we have oddities markets around the world. We have a whole subculture that's much more than I think it continues to be a very strong subculture, but it's much more aggressive and competitive and public, I'd say, since the show. Would you agree with that?
Good words. So I'm a dealer. I buy and sell. You know, social media is not where I do my work. I do my work with objects in space and time. Yeah. And I don't sell online. You have to come into the space and you have to interact with them. And from my point of view, all the things that nobody wanted, everybody wants now.
Yeah.
So things have definitely shifted. I'd have to say in my world, it's gone extremely mainstream. This is like Cabinet Curiosity stuff. You had Morbid Anatomy Museum happened.
Yes.
So the whole Cabinet of Curiosities aesthetic and the cult of wonder and curiosity. I'll call it a cult. It's not really a cult. The culture of wonder and curiosity happened. It caught on. It's still thriving.
Yeah.
So, especially if you deal with objects. So I would say it is quite mainstream.
Yeah. Hearing you talk about the culture of wonder and curiosity, I really like that you put it like that. And on an earlier episode, we had Dylan Turris, formerly of Atlas Obscura, who is part of this popularization as well, and this mainstreaming of it. So it's just interesting to see kind of all these connections. So do you continue to collect yourself for your own personal collection?
Not really. I accumulate. So everything you see here, well, there's a lot of stuff in this room, is stuff that I pick up on my own. I don't go to auctions and bid on stuff. These are things that I pick up.
Yeah.
My job is to basically shop. So life one. So these are things that I run across and I keep some of them.
Yeah. If you can put a finger on it. What differentiates that which you keep versus that which you sell? Like, how do you know that it's something that's going to stay in your private home, in your collection?
It sings to me.
Yeah.
It sings. I see an object. Oh, the little heavenly choir. I don't necessarily keep the most valuable stuff.
Yeah.
Or the most expensive stuff. at all. I keep the things that speak to me. They vibrate on my level. Oscar Wilde probably had a great way of putting it. And also, because they're things I find on my travels and not things I buy at auction,
yeah,
they have a meaning. Like, I'm so, this is my life. It's sort of like a big memory box.
Yeah.
So I keep things, yes, that sing to me and that have meaning. And there are plenty of things I sell that I would love to continue to keep. But, you know, they don't sing the way these things do.
Yeah, I totally understand. Do you think that the people who come to your shop today also are responding to something like that when they purchase an object? Does something sing to them?
I do, because I'm at the People Store. So I have a few spaces there. So I'm not there all the time
anymore. And where's the People Store? Can you tell people who might want to come visit your store?
Beautiful Lambertville, New Jersey.
It is beautiful.
It's a collective. It's a very big, it's in the People Store, I think, opened in 1840. And it's wow. So this big store that with a whole bunch of dealers, but it's people, you could be there for hours and hours. I was going to open my own shop because I missed the salon. I missed poetry readings and showing film. But after decades of owning a shop, I have a life now. And it's really thrilling. I can leave anytime I want. So I do meet them on occasion when I am there, and it warms my cockles because they tell me what these things mean to me. This woman, she's just standing there, she's shaking her head, and she goes, if I could just open a shop, it would look like this. I wish I could do this. The things that I sell are very, they're all curated. Some stuff's decorative, but most of it's curated. So it has a specific meaning, and it doesn't appeal to the vast majority of people. But again, it's selecting, because the people it does appeal to,
yeah,
there's always a commonality, and that makes me very, very happy. So yeah, it sings to them and it reminds them of things or tells a story.
That reminds me, there's a way that you recently described how you consider the space that you have and the aesthetic you have. Do you remember what that is?
It was like dark, whimsical.
I think one of the things that draws people in this community together is our sensitivity to objects and aesthetics, you know, and things that sing, as you said. And not everyone is tuned into that, at least not consciously, maybe until they find someone like you and they even see that that's possible or a way of being in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. And it also links so many of our loves, right? Like museums, travel, ossuaries. There is a mysterious power that happens when we're encountering something that we feel in ourselves in some way that resonates in us, right? Let's talk about our pilgrimage. So back in, oh my goodness, it was 2011 and 2012, I think, you and I took two trips to Italy to work on a project that we had this idea for. And I wonder if you could say a few words about that.
You and I,
yes,
were following our muse. We were going to the home of spirit and matter. We were making a pilgrimage to view objects that spoke to us from these two very different worlds. You and I, both very focused at that time.
Yeah.
We've both changed somewhat. But at that time, we both had this hard focus on exactly the same thing, which was these anatomical waxes, anatomical preservations, churches, yeah, relics, and there's a common language. And so we went to observe this, and it was awesome because we went on this like intellectual and aesthetic pilgrimage. Like, how lucky that life afforded us the chance to do that. It was too much fun. It was like so much was coming at us all the time. And every day was just like, we're going to go to this church at this museum and we're going to soak it in. And we did. So those were two of the best trips.
Yeah. And I just want to back up for listeners who might not know about anatomical waxes or anatomical preparations. If you're in the United States and you know the Mütter Museum, that's the best example of what we're talking about. But in Europe, there are many museums like this, much older, that house these collections of models of humans in various states of being anatomized, and sometimes actual human specimens that show this. And for whatever reason, Evan and I were both very drawn to this imagery, and we had this idea of doing a book that was going to be tracing the aesthetics of the corpse, right? And I would do the photography and Evan would write. We were going to write it together at one point, but it was clear that we just had different opinions. You were much more sure of yourself than I was. I'm always a shade of gray, like maybe this and maybe that. And you had certainty about what you thought. And I think your voice, you're also the better writer of the two of us, I would say. So we decided that I would take the photographs, Evan would write the book. And we even did a proposal of it, and it just wasn't the time at that time.
It's written.
Yeah.
I mean, you got the wax Venus.
Yes, that's what came out of it for me, is I decided to use one object that we saw on our trip, and this is the anatomical Venus. And for those listeners who have not seen one, just Google anatomical Venus in quotes and you will be blown away. I can almost promise you. And know when you see these photographs that these are life-sized figures made of wax, originally in 18th century Florence, with great funding, the best wax, the best glass, the best everything, like princely creations to delight and seduce the general public into being interested in human anatomy, not medical students. I think that's really interesting. And this was a big, both Evan and I were really, I think, confounded by how these could be the way someone chose to represent the body, because they're so, some would say erotic, certainly ecstatic and strange and uncanny. But when we went to Italy, and this is the beauty of travel, right? We saw images like that everywhere, in squares, in museums, in churches. Like, so we really were interested in kind of decoding this mysterious thing that we saw. I guess that's what it became for me, at least. But it was a really wonderful, wonderful trip. And that's when we fell in love with Naples, which maybe will be a future episode, because Naples deserves its own episode.
Yes. And more broadly, fell in love with the Italian aesthetic, which yes. I was already there with England. I was already there with Germany. But Italy, so seductive.
So seductive.
But it was a deep immersion.
Yeah.
It was a deep immersion that we did. And the way that the spiritual body, for me, the way the language of science and medicine at the very beginning sort of overlapped with the visual language of the spirit. And watching what the corpse meant in one tradition and then watching it evolve in another tradition was the most fascinating thing. And that book is... chapters are finished. Your pictures are there, the text there, but the world has changed.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is a whole nother subject. The world has changed since we made that trip, which is also fascinating.
Yes. And I think what you're alluding to, if I'm guessing correctly, is that the idea of displaying or photographing human remains has changed a little bit since then. There's been a big shift for better and for worse, I would say. And that is a whole other conversation that, maybe that's a future episode, thinking about the ethics of displaying human remains. And that's something that we've certainly talked about a great deal, as have others in our community. But it looks like we're running out of time here. So I just kind of want to ask, if listeners want to find out more about you and your work, is there a place they can go?
Well, I'm a Luddite. I don't have much of an online presence. ObscuraWest.com is my
perfect
kind of, fortunately, basic website. It has links to lectures and articles.
Oh, great.
Oddities is kind of everywhere. I think it's on YouTube and it's on Discovery. They still air it sometimes.
That's very cool. I have three questions that I ask all the guests at the end of our discussions. So first of all, I wanted to ask you, how does the idea of death animate your life and work?
Yeah. Kind of central too. I am BRCA. So they call that the cancer gene. So death, premature death for women is unfortunately runs in the family. So I have had cancer several times, starting when I was in my 20s. I
Wow.
mean, I was very young. So I've been in the hospital and chemo and radiation, and I'm knocking on wood now, I'm fine, but death is ever present. And my mother had obviously the gene, and she was sick before I was born. So I was kind of born into this. Death was in the room, and they tried to shield me from it. But as a child, you know. So I decided to make friends with and explore this thing that was, always at hand. I started out in Victorian hair work in 19th century mourning and funereal stuff. So death was really a focus. Then it broadened into natural history. Although the history of science, natural history, these are all things that are kind of predicated on dead objects. I mean, that you have the dead, you're talking about the dead objects. You teach through dead objects.
That's
So
a good point.
I would say death is ever present, but not in a morbid way, just acknowledged. And also, in a way, death makes everything more precious. It gives life its meaning, and everything is heightened and precious because of it. So, yeah, it's absolutely. But I'm no longer a goth. So I was a goth. I'm no longer a traditional goth. I'm a post-goth. So I was a goth in the 80s.
You're an intellectual goth.
I'm aesthetic goth. I like post-goth
I like
because I'm
post-goth too.
post-punk. So still the elements are there.
It's been integrated differently.
Correct. Correct.
I love that. And that leads in very well into my next question, which I think you've already answered, but I'll give you more of a chance to discuss it. If you could live forever, would you, and why or why not?
Very good question that I've asked myself because I have frequent health scares. Once you have my health history, the last one I was really knocked about. So, although I'm familiar with it, I'm friends with it, I'm not ready. I'm not ready yet. I'm having too good a time here in the material world. I don't know that I'd like to live forever because if I was living forever and everyone was living forever in a world in which nothing died, I think it would be like the gods of old. I think it would be the classical gods where what has meaning, what has urgency? I'll fix it in post. It doesn't matter. It really death heightens life. But yeah, in a world in which I didn't die, but everyone else did, that's problematic too, isn't it?
I don't know. Is it?
Yeah, I well, then you get to see things change and you get to see like aesthetics change and the rise and fall of civilizations. It could be godlike. I would say it's not a big yes. It's probably a no, but I'm gonna reserve. Wait before I give my ultimate answer.
Okay, I respect that. And finally, has your work changed your thoughts about death and what might or might not happen after the death of the body?
It's funny. This is where you and I always we So Joanna is much more the spirit and I'm much more the matter. But that's why it works so well. These bodies are things we use while we're here in this world. And then once we die, they cease to have meaning. I'm not particularly sentimental about deathly things. I'm not, they don't have a heightened meaning for me, but I think it's a chicken and egg thing. Does my work inform my feelings of death inform my work? I've examined death and been very close to death for a very long time. So I think death's had more of an effect on what I do
Yeah, that's
than what I
interesting.
do having an effect on my views on mortality.
Yeah, I think that's well said. All right. Well, Evan, thank you so much for taking time out and being a part of this podcast. It's been a delight to formally have this conversation with you that we have so much behind closed doors.
It's been lovely to chat, and the people working on the podcast are very nice.
Yay. Yeah, thank you so much, Evan. It was great. Always great to talk to you.
It was lovely.
So after each episode, as regular listeners will know by now, we like to have a little discussion. And so I'm going to invite my producer, Jess, in here. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
And what were your thoughts on today's episode?
Oh, that was so interesting. A really different kind of conversation as well than I feel that we've had so far in the series. Like, especially all the kind of the curious interests and subcultures, that kind of conversation. But actually the reality of reality TV, I wasn't really expecting to go into that so much, but that was fascinating, actually, and the gender politics within that. And I've written in my notes here when Evan described reality TV as a poison and a pock on society, I thought, wow, she's badass, isn't she?
Well, she is. She really is. And very decisive, right? Very bold.
Yeah. Yeah, she's very clear of her opinions and things like that. What did you make of it? Like at the time, like, is it still clear in your mind when they were recording?
Absolutely.
And things like that?
At that time too, I was running the museum. So both of us were in these situations where there was a lot of prestige. And from the outside, it looked like we were having these amazing lives. But the reality is for both of us, we were miserable and more stressed than we've ever been in our entire lives. And I remember she was just stressed all the time. She didn't sleep well. She didn't get enough sleep. That fighting that she was talking about really took a toll on her. You know, that's not her nature. And she really felt like morally obligated to fight. And, you know, speaking to what she's saying too, I didn't say this in the recording, but I had another friend who worked in reality TV who worked on a show called Naked and Afraid, which is a show, like a survival show. And she said something that backed up what Evan said. She said that the women were way better than the men at surviving. The men would just get frustrated eventually and drink water that was going to make them sick, and women didn't. But she wasn't allowed to show that because basically they had to kind of change it because women were winning everything. And so really this idea of like the stories that we tell, you know, creating a sense of what's possible. But it also goes the other way where these people who are just financially conservative think that the people that watch TV don't want to hear another story. So it's a kind of that circular thing that I've seen a few times, you know, where it's very sad, but there, reality is not quite the word. I would say unscripted is a better word. And that was my experience too on the show is, as she alluded to, you know, they wanted me to say things. I'm like, I'm not an actor, you know, I'm me. I don't want to say this. I'm an unpaid
actor. What
was
the setup? What did they want you to do?
Basically, they wanted me to say things that I didn't feel comfortable and that weren't me. And I kept saying, that's not me. I don't want to do that, which is why I didn't make it on the show. I wasn't really willing to compromise.
Evan was saying that the kind of the male studio producers, whatever, were saying these things to her because they felt the audience skewed younger and male. Because I always think of this kind of alternative type culture thing as skewing more female. I don't know whether maybe that's just because I'm female, and so I kind of see it through that lens. But that was an interesting thing that I wouldn't have expected, actually.
Well, I think that's before they really understood the subculture, and it was more about men and science. You know, this was a science show. That was really the hook because it was a science channel.
Yes, of course.
But, you know, another thing about reality TV that I think, you know, that she was alluding to when she said where the United States is now is my friend who worked on Naked and Afraid was the first one who told me that Trump would win. And she said, he's going to win because he's on reality TV playing a boss. And everyone thinks he's a really good boss. And I was like, that's not true. But I think it is true.
Yeah. It may be a poison and a pock, but it's also powerful.
Well, I
so
think
much
those
plosive
things,
of an alliteration there.
Those things go very close.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They do. It is interesting talking about the travels that you guys did together.
Yeah.
And the anatomical Venuses and things like that. And I would really recommend anyone looks at Joanna's book. I've got that. It's just fascinating. And I used to love going to the Wellcome Collection in London as like a treat, you know, and as a kid or whatever. And I loved looking at the skin and the hair and the models and things like that. Just fascinating, you know? And it's
yes,
like the way you were saying how well funded that was, you know, when these things were being created, when these anatomical figures, you know, the best wax and materials and that. That's, yeah, it's just very different. And then I know I was going to ask you, Eva mentioned how she kind of fell in love with the Italian aesthetic and how it was different from like
British
or German or whatever. What can you kind of summarize what the Italian aesthetic is?
I can. And I actually had an amazing experience with this right before we were going. Well, when I was doing a photography project that preceded my time with Evan, that led to Morbid Anatomy, actually. So Morbid Anatomy started as a blog supporting this exhibition I did about medical museums. And I had a very small stipend to go to Europe and photograph. And so I started in England and I worked with a medical collection at Guy's Hospital. I just knocked on the door and I made friends with the curator, and he's lovely. We've been friends ever since. But he let me photograph, and then I said, he's like, what else are you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to Italy, and I'm really excited to see those waxes because they're more Baroque and not 19th century. And he just kind of shook his head. He's like, honey, it's not about Baroque or 19th century. It's about Italian versus British. And that was a nuance that I didn't understand being from the United States, right? But then you go to Italy and you see these incredible waxes. And let's make sure to put one of these in the show notes so people can just see.
Absolutely.
Like, you need to look, people. Like, nothing I can say can communicate how strange and beautiful and hypnotizing these figures are. But you go and you see these anatomical waxes and you compare them to what you see in Britain, where the waxes looked like decaying corpses, essentially.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah.
They were brutal. The ones in Italy are elegant. They show no signs of death. They look like they're sleeping. They're seductively beautiful. Their skin is perfect and flawless. They wear pearls. They have tumbling, beautiful hair, and they're in these gorgeous boxes. But when you're in Italy and you walk around Florence, of all places, which is where these are created, there are hyper-perfect human statues everywhere. And when you go to Pompeii, which we also did on that trip, and the museum in Naples where you see the sculptures they found there, you're like, oh, they've been doing this for millennia. If they're going to make a body, it's going to be beautiful, or they're not going to do it. That's who they are, you know? So there's this love of the body and this mastery of the perfect human body that I think has been preoccupying Italian art for millennia, you know, since the ancient world, that we just don't have in the British tradition or the United States tradition or the German tradition.
And that makes me think, what was the word that Evan used at the beginning that means moved or motivated by beauty when she described herself as
an aesthete? An aesthete.
Aesthete.
Yes.
Ah. So is that taken from aesthetic somewhere in the word, or aesthete?
Yeah, exactly. So
that's,
it's, you know, as she said, Oscar Wilde is one of the most famous aesthetes. Mm. So these are people that that make a life around their love of beauty and being surrounded by beauty. And that's what really resonated for Evan. And if you see her home, you will see it's like an installation artwork. It's an incredible experience to go into her home.
Yeah, I think that's just a great word, aesthete. It's just not something I'd ever heard about before, and I can see why that would be a great descriptor for her. Well, thank you, Joanna.
Yeah,
that was
thank
great.
Thank you. Great. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, reflection, or even a question, send us a voice note on WhatsApp. You can find the number in the show notes. We might just feature it in a future episode as part of our listener offerings. If you would like to find out more about Morbid Anatomy and what we're up to, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at Morbid Anatomy. Or check out our Substack at mementomorbid.substack.com, where you will find links and images related to our conversation today. And again, I do encourage you to look up an anatomical Venus if you've not seen one. Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra,
Studio engineer Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer Stephen Rajam.